Talking Ball. What was that you said? Texas Talking Ball. Gonna hoop upside your head.
Hello and welcome to the Tribcast. This is WGU Texas Chancellor Ray Martinez. WGU Texas is a nonprofit online university expanding access to quality higher education for Texas residents. Since we're an online university, we don't have a football team, and we don't have to worry about beating OU. And now here's your host, our Texas Tribune endowed professor of podcasting, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the second week of August. Joining me is editor-in-chief and CEO Evan Smith.
That's a very ominous pause there, Reeve.
Well, I can never remember your title.
Don't even say
it's always changing. And I always just choose two of them. I don't
tamer.
Do all of them. All five titles that you have.
That's fine.
Reporter Jay Root is also here.
Hello.
And reporter Morgan Smith is also joining us.
Hello.
So they have easy titles.
It's a pretty somber beginning, isn't it?
Yes. Well, we're mourning the loss of WGU Texas football team. You know, it's pretty sour.
Nice try. Yeah. way to go, Reeve.
Well, you wanna bring up the mood by talking about C-Scope? That's gonna
yes.
be our first topic.
Let's just make Evan talk about it.
I haven't gotten a cheerful email from Thomas Ratliff within the last 2 minutes, so I'm worried he's mad at me.
We should probably, if we're gonna talk about C-Scope, we should probably try to explain what C-Scope is. What does C-Scope even stand for?
So it's actually not an acronym. It is a word that has been made up, a title that
it's
has
not
been
a word.
Made up. That it's supposed to, I think it's some type of combination of curriculum sequence, and that has become C-Scope. And what it
no
is...
No wonder this is so controversial.
Right.
You can't even explain what the name is.
For those among us who are not in kind of this pocket of grassroots activists who have gone after this and who are not at the primarily smaller rural schools that use this tool, it is both a kind of scheduler, a lesson planner, and it is also a curriculum lesson plans that school districts teachers can choose from to help them teach the Texas standards that are set by the State Board of Education.
And at some point this year, or maybe before this year, but especially during the regular session and apparently ever since, because it just keeps getting sort of more and more in the news, it is among the more controversial things in the state.
It is. This is something that really started brewing towards the end of last year, and it happened both because there was this air of secrecy around C-Scope. There were some rules that this co-op of state education centers that had developed it said that, you know, they're very proprietary about it. They wouldn't let teachers review these lessons. They wouldn't let parents review these lessons. And then the lessons, kind of a few examples of the lessons made their way onto the internet, and a group of activists became very, very upset by them because of a perceived anti-American, pro-liberal bias, and it eventually made its way onto the Glenn Beck Show. And here we are.
Ooh, what
are
the blaze.
What are the examples? What's the best example that they have of there being liberal bias?
So
I really haven't heard
The one that is the most commonly cited is there is a question that it's a social studies question, and it asks students to imagine. It asks students whether, from the British perspective, the Boston Tea Party during the American Revolution was a terrorist act. And there are a few others that, you know, will ask students to.
And that's anti-American because why?
Because I think it's.
You're not supposed to imagine other perspectives. If you're Americans, do not
so
think
the idea,
about.
The idea
other
here is that Americans fighting to establish their independence from England. They're saying one possibility is they can be viewed as an act of domestic terrorism.
Well, when you take the events of the Boston Tea Party in specific, when you're kind of making this aggressive gesture against the empire that was taking over you, that this was an act of terrorism.
Obviously,
the perspective of the empire,
the people that are upset with this question are worried that you know, they might be used to malign the noble Occupy Wall Street crowd.
So this is basically – this is like the fight that we had a couple of years ago at the State Board of Education over curriculum where they're scrutinizing everything that may be taught to see whether the interpretation of it could differ from their own interpretation of it, and they're smiting anybody who dares to suggest multiple points of view are acceptable to teach.
And that was more an example of what would be seen as an anti-American thing, right. Not a pro-liberal thing, which is are different.
Well, I think that there's kind of this broader concern that it's this curriculum that's instilling these values in children that are, you know, teaching them that America or the United States is a bad country.
They're not pro-destruction of property enough, it sounds like.
So anyways, that's where it's generated a lot of heat among grassroots activists. It's, you know, elected officials definitely felt that pressure during the legislative session. And so towards the end of it, we had Senator Dan Patrick stand up and say he had reached an agreement with these education service centers that produce these lessons and they were no longer going to produce them. And so everyone thought, okay, it's the end of C-scope. Well, it turns out that since the education service centers no longer have the copyright over these lessons, they're in the common domain. And all these school districts that have been using them, and that's about, I think it's around 800 school districts in the state. We have 1,200.
Two-thirds of the...
Yeah. But primarily the smaller ones, so student percentage-wise, it's a little bit lower than that. They said, well, we only have 3 months before the next school year begins. We're in a bind here. And if these lessons are now in the common domain, we're going to use them while we are figuring out what we're going to do next. That news kind of made its way around. It's become very controversial to the point where we have one school district. Parents there have obtained an injunction against the school district. It's temporary. We're still waiting the results of a final hearing. And I mean, really, it comes down to it's unclear as to whether no one really has jurisdiction over school districts to say, hey, you can't use these lessons.
But I wonder, are the parent and the district that you're referring to is where?
It's Llano ISD.
In Llano. So have the parents in Llano actually seen the curriculum, or have they only seen the flyers excoriating C-scope? I wonder how much of the specifics of this are actually in front of the people who are upset.
And I think that is part of the issue. I think the other issue is it's hard to really tell how many. I mean, when I looked at the court filing, there's six plaintiffs. Only two of them have students in that school district. So you have this situation where potentially it could be a couple of dissatisfied parents who are going to create a huge headache for a lot of school districts. And all of this kind of acrimony has been amplified because we're going into a primary season and you have...
Everything is now political.
Exactly.
And the fight that we had a couple of years ago at the State Board of Education level over the high school and the science curriculum was in fact a version of this, where people outside of education wanted to dictate what teachers taught.
Well, and what is the difference between the standards that the SBOE sets?
That's a fair question, right?
And these lesson plans. How does the SBOE not have jurisdiction over this?
So the SBOE sets the standards and say, okay, these are the different topics that students need to know. These are the skills that students need to have when they graduate to move on to the next grade level. And to pass the state standardized tests, which are aligned to those standards. The C-scope is just lessons that are, okay, here's an example of how you might teach sixth grade social studies, or here's this particular lesson in C-scope in sixth grade social studies. So it's not even saying teachers don't have control over what they teach in a public school classroom. They have to teach the Texas standards. But what they do have control over is how they teach it. And C-scope is an example of how to teach it.
So they don't have nobody. It's not a mandate. Nobody has to use it.
Right. School districts do not have to use it. I think there has been an issue in some school districts where the school board or the superintendent has required teachers to use that. But I think that in most school districts, it is simply an additional resource for teachers to use if they need it.
And so the big fight is over saying that teachers should not have this option?
The big fight over has become – right. So people are saying teachers should not be able to have this option because – we have all of these concerns about factual errors and biases in it.
And so
But are the concerns? But I come back to this. Are the concerns founded, Or is this just a lot of people making noise without having specifics?
It sounds like that the Boston Tea Party example is not very convincing, I think, to a
well, I'm just wonder, I'm just well, wondering if people are complaining about something specific or they're complaining about something not specific.
That's the other side of it is that so before Senator Patrick came out at the end of the legislative session saying that, okay, this issue has gone away, I've found the solution to it, the State Board of Education was gearing up for a review of all of the C-Scope lessons, and they were going to look individually at all of them and come out with a report at the end of it. And so they stopped that at the end of the legislative session. Well, now they've started it back up again. And I mean, I think I think the lack of a clear understanding of what is actually in these lessons is something that has perhaps allowed this to get so far and become so controversial without real facts.
It's controversial in the way that SBOE things get controversial, which is that it's controversial within a narrow group of people that like nobody else really understands. I mean, I just don't think this has the potential to really break through and become huge in a way that like average voters.
Although you think there's a constituency of people who care about public education. It's fairly large. You know, you'd think that there would be at least a
Glenn Beck has a big audience. I mean, I think it does speak to a lot of things that make people uncomfortable. Sort of, you know, the idea that kids are sort of receiving messages that they can't control, and I mean, it speaks to things that people do care about. People really care about public education,
and it is also it's also become tied up in this anti-Obama message, which is so now there's this idea that the Obama administration Common Core curriculum has been making its way into C-Scope, and that this is and that's something that you know everyone, all Texas policymakers have pretty much taken a stand saying we don't want this, you know, we're
but
Texas.
But is it true?
And I mean, that has not been substantiated. It's just
it's been alleged but not substantiated.
Yeah,
you know, it would be interesting if we could get our hands on the C-Scope curriculum and publish it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is now on the internet because this is where all these school districts
right,
are
now. Right. So I guess my point is if people are complaining about stuff, I think there's clearly going to be it's either correct. The complaints are either legitimate or they're not.
Right.
There's either bias or there isn't. There's either they're teaching stuff that's being alleged or they're not teaching stuff that's being alleged. And I think it would be interesting to be able to see the actual stuff.
But I'm still not clear on what's being alleged. Just that they're teaching something that might be sort of anti-American tinged.
Provocative.
Yeah.
I think that it's interesting that the four of us who are relatively well informed compared to the average person, since this is what we do all the time, we're having a hard time getting our hands around this.
Yeah.
I mean, that should tell you that this is a hard issue to access.
But that's the way the SBOE controversies always seem to be to me. I I've gone to a couple of those meetings, and I have just thank God that I don't have to cover that because I don't get it.
Yet.
I mean, I just we're going to do
a rotation, actually. And then part of this, Morgan, as well, is that Thomas Ratliff, who has become the chief defender of C-Scope.
We should say who that is.
On the State Board of Education, a State Board of Ed member from Mount Pleasant.
Right, and
right.
So you...
He's in the middle of all this, and it's gotten to be political between him and Patrick.
Right, and you look at Ratliff, and he has a very rural district, and these rural schools, these smaller schools, are the schools that need C-Scope, and so he has kind of become this champion of these districts, but also has been very aggressive about challenging Dan Patrick, Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, in their position on all of this, And he's also kind of made a point of asking these questions at State Board of Education meetings that have put the TEA on the spot and had them. We had the general counsel for the TEA say during the last meeting that, no, there's nothing legally that can stop school districts from using these lessons.
So when they debate.
So
next,
we should say
next
Patrick
week.
And Patrick and Ratliff are debating on the 24th of August in Tyler.
And is there actually anything substantive that can come of that, or is it just sort of they're going to debate what does or doesn't constitute a pro-liberal bias?
Well, I think that one of the hopes, I think the way Thomas Ratliff has described his hopes for this debate is that, well, maybe we can actually get away from some of the rhetoric and have some substance on the table. You know, what is actually wrong with C-Scope? What evidence do we have that this is wrong with C-Scope? And kind of have that in front of a bigger audience so that there can be a better understanding of the situation.
And it sounds like there was, but there was some secrecy around it ahead of time.
There was, which is
something that makes things like this sort of spin out of control, I think, is when people don't understand what their kids are being taught.
Yeah, I think that was very much, and I think that when initially kind of approached on these matters, that the education service centers brushed off the people who were inquiring about it, and I think that kind of took it out to the blogosphere, and it just really snowballed after that.
The blogosphere is the mattresses of today.
Well, there's still a blogosphere?
Oh, yeah. We're in the middle of it right now.
Okay. I thought Twitter killed the blogosphere.
Oh, it's there.
All right.
David Dewhurst recently weighed in on this in one of his, I guess...
It's a lame transition, Reeve.
His better moments of the week. let's move on to David Dewhurst, basically. Jay had a story about David Dewhurst, the lieutenant governor, who was running to be the lieutenant governor. Yesterday. Yeah, today's Wednesday. Yesterday was Tuesday. And it was just the latest in Dewhurst's sort of no good, very bad year. You want to explain what the latest is, Jay?
Yeah, well, he owes people about $1 million, vendors, including some, six-figure amounts, people that are owed $150,000 for campaign services, largely consultants. And there was a lot of grumbling among these vendors. They're very, very upset that Dewhurst has gone on to run for re-election now, hiring new people, obviously using some of his vast fortune for his campaign, and paying people to continue political work when he hasn't paid his past bills. So this reached me, and we did a story about it. And Dewhurst they've essentially blamed it on Buddy Barfield, who was the former campaign manager for the Dewhurst Senate race, and who allegedly stole a lot of money. The lawyer for Buddy Barfield declined comment, so we don't have his side of the story. But that led to more grumbling among the people that I talked to, because they're like, well, look, if you get mugged on the way home, you don't call your phone provider and say, I didn't pay my bill.
Dewhurst, because they think the Dewhurst is making an excuse when the reality is pay the money you were owed.
Right. And the Dewhurst campaign was very careful to point out that it's the committees that owe this money and not Dewhurst. But then we quoted one of the vendors, Jeff Rowe, who's owed over $100,000, and he said that really didn't wash with him, because he said that David Dewhurst himself committed to pay this bill.
Look, dude is worth $250 million, or was at one point. I mean, it'd be reasonable to think that Dewhurst will have his time to fight Buddy Barfield in court and recoup the money. But at the end of the day, Buddy Barfield didn't steal the money from the vendors. Buddy Barfield stole the money from the lieutenant governor. Therefore, the lieutenant governor should dip into his own assets, pay the vendors, and then seek to reclaim that money through the legal process.
How involved
is that? Is there any way that's not the case? It seems pretty cut and dry.
I mean, where do you draw the line between David Dewhurst and the committee? Because David Dewhurst gave money to the committee. Buddy Barfield was in control of these funds, and he allegedly, did all kinds of illegal things and siphoned off money.
But couldn't the lieutenant governor, the committee is still in existence as a fundraising entity, even though the campaign is long over. The lieutenant governor could make all this go away today. He could write a check for $1 million to the campaign today. Campaign could turn around, pay every single vendor who is grouchy in your story, Ryan Gravatt and Mike Basilis and Jeff Rose and this one and that one. They could all get paid. And this whole thing would go away. It would retreat to back behind the curtain, where Dewhurst then steps up his effort to recoup this money from Buddy Barfield through the legal process. He could do that.
Yeah,
right?
and honestly, I mean, if the answer after you get the grumbling, you start writing a story. If I had called the Dewhurst campaign, they said, wait a second, we're paying this, hold on, then this would not have been as big of a story. It would have been a story, but it still wouldn't have been as big of a story.
The site needs content, Jay.
it wouldn't have been as big of a story, because then it's basically, well, okay, these people have had to wait a while, but they're going to get paid. But that's not what
More
he said.
More of a post than a story.
That's not what they said. What they said was...
From the blogosphere.
What they said was Buddy Barfield...
stole a bunch of money, and we're trying to recover that money. Which sort of, and there was no elaboration, even though there were obviously questions.
Well,
can you elaborate?
I mean, how unusual is it a year after a campaign for this level of debt to be still owed to vendors and consultants? And I mean, is this?
It certainly happens, but it usually happens when people's aren't running for office anymore.
It's rarely this much, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is a lot of money. This is a fair amount of money. Now, I feel like I need to point out that, you know, some of these vendors, including the one that I believe was owed the most money, On Message, which is a media firm, was paid $6 or $7 million. But and so that was sort of some of the pushback that you get is, hey, it's not like these people didn't get any money. But then the people who are owed money is like, well, I know, but
some of those vendors actually I thought were quite gracious to you in the story. Ryan Gravatt is an example. They were like, look, we just hope that this will all get worked out. They're not chaining themselves to the Dewhurst's front door until they get paid.
Right. But it's also fair to say that behind the scenes, so some of the people are very, you know, they feel like. I mean, in some cases, they had to buy postage, you know, in order to get the mailer out. They had to contract with subcontractors here in Austin who didn't get paid. And so, you know, people that didn't get paid $50,000 or $60,000 are pretty upset about it.
How much can you really put this on specifically Dewhurst's shoulders, though? I mean, how involved is he in the day-to-day accounting of his campaign, or is it possible that he just didn't know?
Does it matter? What is the oldest rule in politics, articulated best by, I'm not sure, it was around the time of Reagan, this was said the first time I heard it, was the fish rots from the head down. I mean, it doesn't make a difference. It's your campaign. You own this.
Yeah, well, you know, I look at these things and I think, how much is that negative publicity cost you? Did that cost him $900,000? Is that $900,000 worth of negative publicity? I mean, we don't know. I mean, it could be something that would end up in an ad somewhere where, you know, doesn't even pay his bills. I mean, that you could see something like that happening. So you think, would it be worth it to somebody who's worth over, I mean, certainly $150 million easily?
At least. I thought it was
right.
Important.
I don't know. It's hard to know. These forms aren't accurate, but. Aren't precise, but $150 to $250 million, let's say, okay,
a few million.
Would it be worth it to just go? You know what?
Write the damn check,
and let's just get this done.
Write the check, and also, you know, look, he's going into a campaign that's going to be quite difficult. Whatever the outcome of it is, he's going into a very tough race for lieutenant governor. He does not need any additional things. Right.
I think that's correct. I mean, this is a very, very competitive race. It's hard to come back from a very high profile loss and then, you know, you run for re-election. You just sort of. So, I mean, and he said this himself. Dewhurst said, I realize it's harder to stay on top than it is to get.
So
to
if
the
you're
top.
A vendor, if you're a vendor contacted by the Dewhurst for lieutenant governor campaign. Do you take the business?
Yes.
Do you say we don't do our business on credit?
Well, you know who did get paid?
Yeah, I think you take what business comes your way.
The lawyers and the accountants got paid. The lawyers in particular. There was some.
Sounds like the accountants were messing up.
The lawyers always get paid.
Well, the accountants, the bills weren't that large. There were some fairly large legal bills. If you look at, I think maybe there was a report in April. I can't remember exactly the timing of it, but. The in between April, let's say, and July, there were several law firms that had been owed money that on the latest reports they drop off because they got paid, so they were no longer listed as a debt or obligation. So the lawyers, obviously, you know, you have legal issues ongoing, including I would presume related to Buddy Barfield. So you have to pay those guys.
But you were sort of shrugging off the C-scope thing as something that only matters to a narrow set of people. I mean, when you get down to like the intricacies of campaign accounts and vendors, I mean,
the difference is C-scope doesn't matter to Jay. Yeah. This does. Right. Jay happens to be in this narrow set of people.
I can't really argue with that. I mean, this is definitely sort of an insider type of deal.
Like, does this translate to the election, really?
However, anybody can, any person can understand that somebody that doesn't pay their bills. I mean,
and it's just kind of there's this perception of, okay, you had all of these expenses left over from your last campaign. You clearly have the money to make that right, and then we're sitting here watching you running up a ton of new expenses for office again. I mean, just kind of the perception of it, even if you don't understand the ins and outs, it's just you can feel it makes you feel a little bit off.
Thank you, Morgan.
I was going to say maybe his
accountants.
Even though
you said C-scope doesn't matter.
Yeah. Maybe his accountants use the C-scope accounting curriculum, and that's the problem.
Well, look, I...
That's why he's so against it now.
No, I do sort of agree that this is kind of a little bit inside baseball. And I, again, would point out from the perspective of the lieutenant governor's people, David Dewhurst himself does not owe this money. The committees owe this money. But everybody who's been around politics knows that Dewhurst has never hesitated to dip into his vast fortune to pay for his political endeavors. And this is one of those political endeavors that went south, and now there's $1 million out there, and people are left holding the bag, and they really want to get paid. I mean, I talked to some people who really, they've had to pay vendors, their subcontractors off, had to pay postage. People really feel like they need this money, and you know, I think it was a story that was worth doing. I'm not, you know, it's. I don't think you'll see necessarily, you know, vast iterations going forward, but, you know, unless he pays the money off, we'll do a follow-up.
Well, then maybe we should move down a little bit. We've talked about the lieutenant governor's race. Last week we talked a lot about the governor's race. What are the other races to watch that were not sort of not the top of the ticket fights?
I'm really interested in the emergence fairly early in an election cycle of primary challengers to sitting House members. The group of House members who have occasionally, if not often, been attacked by the Tea Party as insufficiently conservative. These are Republican members, but they're seen as more liberal Republican members. This would include J.D. Sheffield, Bennett Ratliff, Lance Gooden, Angie Chen Button. I mean, honestly, these people, only in Texas would these people be derided as liberals. But nonetheless, the way the breakdown of the parties in Texas goes, a third Democratic, a third traditional Republican, and a third Tea Party. The Tea Party is constantly after not so much the Democrats as Republicans who they think don't uphold the orthodoxy adequately. And
but it's not
they've
just
identified those members, and they've recruited energetic challengers to the group I just mentioned and a handful of other people. And
do you think Donna Campbell, the senator from New Braunfels, is being attacked from the right?
I think the Donna Campbell challenge, which has yet to materialize in a serious way. The guy who announced as a candidate against Donna Campbell was not the name we've all been waiting for. A lot of us who think we know stuff, which is itself in question, have been waiting for State Representative Lyle Larson from San Antonio to step into that race against Donna Campbell, who drew a two-year term last time. It's not so much about her ideology. It's about the fact that San Antonio feels like when they lost Jeff Wentworth, they lost a senator who represented San Antonio. Her geographic base is New Braunfels, not San Antonio. And so they had a little bit of buyer's remorse possibly from a civic more than ideological standpoint.
A geographic standpoint.
But to this moment, we do not have a San Antonio challenger. We have a guy, I think his last name is Novak, who has gotten into this race, who has ties to San Antonio, but actually lives, if you can believe it, farther away from San Antonio. He lives in San Marcos. New Braunfels is more like San Antonio than San Marcos is, just from a geographic standpoint. So, no, Donna Campbell's challenger is about something else. I think the bulk of the challengers who've announced a sitting Republican are people who are coming at these people from the right. Now, it remains to be seen whether, as Jonathan Stickland told me some months ago, we're coming back and we're bringing friends is going to be the battle cry of the Tea Party. They want to expand their numbers. They had reliably, as we've talked about on this podcast before, 20 to 25 people who would vote, you know, in a block on most issues, but that wasn't enough to derail the alliance between the Democrats and the more traditional Republicans on some issues. And so the Tea Party had some victories, but not as many as they would have liked. And they think this is their route there. They think they can have more power next session if there are greater numbers on their side. They think they might be able to mount a successful challenge to Speaker Strauss. You know, there's been talk of people challenging Strauss this next time. Lois Culcorp's name has come up. I heard John Smithy's name actually this week as a potential challenger to the Speaker. We'll have to see if any of those things materialize.
What do you think about Rodney Anderson trying to come back?
Rodney Anderson trying to come back against Linda Harper Brown is definitely the Tea Party thinking that they're going after a more vulnerable member. Harper Brown's a little bit more conservative than Bennett Ratliff and then Lance Gooden, than some of these guys who are getting more clear-cut left-right challenges.
Has Anderson mentioned whether or not if he won that race, he would keep a bag of candy on his desk the way Linda Harper Brown does?
That's all it's about for you?
Yeah.
It's a very important question for those of us who sit in the press pit.
Really? Mm-hmm. Does the C in C-scope stand for candy? I guess we already established it doesn't stand for anything.
Yeah.
So. It's a trick question. But I think that, you know, the campaign season is getting started earlier than it normally does. And, you know, and those of us in the news business who are lamenting the departure of the 83rd, the 97th called special session of the 83rd legislature, whatever it was.
I'm still not convinced.
I think you're the only one who's
I'm not convinced
that.
It's yeah. over. I think the governor could call them back any moment now.
You think so?
Yeah.
Campus carry?
Yeah, exactly.
Tuition revenue bonds?
Yeah,
that could be it?
He just really wants those tuition revenue bonds.
Maybe he'll call them back so that they can give WGU a football team.
Yeah, maybe. Right? That went over about as well as my WGU football
yes,
joke.
Yes, it did. Or if possible, worse. So I'm just going to take my sippy cup and go home here.
So there's plenty of excitement that we'll have plenty of time to talk about up and down the ballot for 2014. Anyone disagree with that, Jay?
I thought you were trying to end on that, so
I'm not.
I wasn't going to say
I don't want
anything.
This to ever end. This has been so much fun.
Well, you know, Boogie's got a challenger as well. Senator,
I'm just gonna,
Senator Whitmire.
Oh, I was going to end on that.
Oh. Well, he has it. So you didn't talk about you.
Well, no, Boogie does have a challenger, but this person has run previously. He's been a judicial candidate, Ross said. He's got a nice website, though.
He does.
He does.
Do we know his name?
Which guy is this?
Damien Lacroix.
Lacroix. He's a lawyer. He's running against Senator.
He's a Republican or Democratic challenger?
Democrat Whitmire's running against Democrat. Senator Whitmire in the primary.
So is he a Tea Party Democrat? What pattern does he fall into?
I just think he's...
Is that the only... Well, of course, Donna Campbell, I guess, but is that the...
I'm not aware yet of any challenge. Well, you know, then you've got... Well, you've got a couple people, obviously, who are lining up to run against Wendy Davis. That's going to be an interesting
Greg
fight,
Abbott.
Depending upon what she... Oh, well, you're making an assumption, yeah. Reeve.
I think it's a pretty safe assumption. I think when every Democratic group happens to announce their draft Wendy campaign on the same day, it's a pretty safe bet that that is the plan.
It's almost like she can't run for state senate now. She has to run for governor. I mean, it just, you know, can you imagine the letdown?
Do you think Connie Burton will feel let down when she moves to a different race and then she's already done this video attacking Wendy Davis?
She'll probably keep
she'll
doing
feel
that.
Okay.
You know, Ross has said all along he thinks Victor Vandegrift's going to get in that race. You know, Connie Burton may have company, just not Mark Shelton. But,
I think that's going to be, particularly if it ends up being an open race, that will be a very spirited primary, wouldn't you guess?
The Republican primary.
Absolutely.
Who do the Democrats try and keep that Senate seat?
I have heard Nicole Collier's name, but not only Nicole Collier's name mentioned for that. I mean, I think the Democrats, Ross has said on this, I think he said last week, right, that
he said all sorts of
it's a plus 17 Republican district in a non-presidential year. So it's going to be an uphill battle for anybody on the Democratic side.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank Shiny Ribs for doing our music. And we would like to encourage you to send questions and comments to tribcast@texastribune.org. And on behalf of Morgan, Jay, Evan, and our producer, Todd, unless anyone has anything else to add the last second, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Bye, y'all.
Is that an Aspen Institute sippy cup?
Shut up, Morgan.